Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde, and today we're talking about the future of Seattle, what it's going to look like, what it's going to feel like, how many people are going to be living here, how dense is the housing going to be, because we're talking about a never-released draft comprehensive plan that Erica C. Barnett with Publicola was able to obtain through a public records request. Very cool, Erica. Also with us, political consultant Sandeep Kaushik. But Erica, starting with you, this original draft plan, it sounds like, was a lot more ambitious than the plan that the Harrell administration ended up releasing.
Yeah, we got a copy, or, you know, I got a copy through this records request of this August version of the plan, which is, you know, almost a year late coming out. And they were ready to release it more or less last August, they being the Office of Planning and Community Development, which is the planning department at the city. But between August and when it was finally released last month, it got really whittled down. There was going to be just very high level, a lot more density along, or a lot more density allowed, I should say, along arterial streets and some streets that you wouldn't necessarily think of as arterial streets, and deep into the neighborhoods, these neighborhood nodes where there can be apartment buildings of up to six stories. There are 24 in the plan that was released. There were, you know, up to 48, 50 in the original plan, and a lot of other stuff just got cut out. A lot of talk about the current racial segregation of Seattle, the kind of lasting effects of redlining were excised from the plan. And sort of all that stuff, all the bad stuff that we did in the past is kind of portrayed in this new plan as being over and done with. As in, you know, there are not many lasting ramifications, but we do need to know about the past in order not to repeat it. And I find that really significant. It doesn't have big policy impacts necessarily, but I think it's really interesting that in going through this plan, the mayor's office, you know, really took out a lot of the context that sort of
took out the history, took out the history.
Not just the history, but the history is still in there. What's not in there is that the history is still with us, and we still have neighborhoods that are racially segregated because of decisions we made that we have not fully undone.
Sandeep Kaushik, what do you think?
Well, I think the documents and the earlier version of the plan that Erica unearthed through her records request is really interesting. And it shows, look, I mean, it's not a surprise that there's, you know, various iterations of a comprehensive plan document like this, and that they would go through, it would go through a process of change and evolution. Like, that's not, that's pretty standard sort of how government procedure works. But it is interesting that the evolution of this plan was initially to go in a more ambitious direction in terms of growth, and it got dialed back. The second piece of it about the, you know, language around, like, Seattle's history of, you know, redlining and racist exclusion, I'm less, you know, troubled by that some of that stuff got exercised. It's still acknowledged in there that that happened and existed. But, like, I find that there's a lot of performative virtue signaling that happens in Seattle, as a matter of course, too much as it is.
Yeah, you should probably read the plan, though, Sandeep, because that's not what I'm talking about.
Well, what you're saying is that they continue to acknowledge that there is this historical experience that Seattle had of exclusionary race-based zoning, but they sort of dial back some of the language about, oh, you know, racism.
I'll tell you what they actually did and why it matters.
Okay.
They didn't, I mean, I don't know about dialing back the language about racism. I mean, there is an anti-displacement document, which also really got dramatically changed, that I'm going to be writing about some more. So a little preview of that. And that does impact policy. And there's also quite a bit of stuff in there that's, you know, not just about racial covenants and redlining, but, you know, just about the history of Seattle and how it got settled and how, you know, who was allowed and who wasn't. That's all still in there.
Yeah.
And it did get cut back a bit, but that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, you know, this explicit language that says, you know, there was this situation in which, you know, certain neighborhoods were white, certain neighborhoods were black, and these were not equal neighborhoods and they were not treated equally. And that still persists today because of the zoning that we have in those neighborhoods. And the way to fix that, one way to fix that, is to allow specifically apartments and rental housing deep inside those white single-family neighborhoods. And that's what's all gone. And when you're talking about a comprehensive plan, I mean, it sets a framework for policy, but this is not legislation. It's not like a zoning bill. So the reason it's important when you're making a 10-year plan or a 20-year plan for the city to acknowledge that and to say, the problem is zoning and we need to fix the zoning, is that then you've set a framework for people to fix the zoning in the future, you know, after Bruce Harrell is no longer mayor and after the city council is gone and the next city council. And so I do think that stuff is really important. And because if you just say, you know, in the misty past, there was racism, but we fixed that now. And I'm not saying it goes that far, but if you sort of consign it to the dusty past, then you don't need to make any real changes. And this plan doesn't really make any real changes to the way that we're already planning the city and the way the city is built.
So, Erica, like, are you saying with the changes that they did make to zoning, they should have included that language, or that they excised both the density and this language? I mean, I'm trying to understand. So, both of them are problems.
Yeah, you have to understand the nature of the plan. So it's not, right. So they're not making any changes to zoning with this plan. They are saying, so it's not,
adding
so
density,
it's a roadmap. They're not, so yes, so it's a roadmap for future density. I just want to make that clear. This is not like a zoning plan. It's not putting, you know, an apartment in your neighborhood. But I'm saying that both are important. And, you know, and there are different levels to this plan. So there's like policies, you know, so those are like, here is what the city should do in the future when it adopts legislation. And then there's, you know, frameworks and goals and things like that. So I'm saying that both are, you know, are dialed back. It was dramatic enough for me to, you know, to write a story about it. And I think it's a pretty dramatic change.
So my question then for Sandeep, is that it seems like it must have been a political calculation to take it out based on some of the experience that Murray administration had back in whenever that was, 2017, when they included that language. And I agree with you. It's unfortunate that we can't be honest about, you know, what happened and what's happening in the present. But is that what's going on here, do you think, Sandeep? I don't know if you know.
Well, what I think is going on is that, look, the argument that in order to rectify past discrimination and racism, we need to blow up single-family zoning and add lots of density into, you know, what were historically white single-family neighborhoods It's an argument that I think lands really, really well with left progressives, but it's a controversial argument that also turns off some people.
It's funny that you say that, given what you were saying last week, Sandeep, about the chamber poll showing that everybody wants density in their neighborhoods.
About two-thirds. There's still a third of people that are not on board with the, you know, kind of urbanist move. And so if dialing back some of the rhetoric, even though it doesn't have any kind of real substantive policy implications in this document, makes this plan go down a little easier. I guess I'm not that worked up about that. I am, however, more interested in the fact that, as you point out, in terms of policy, they are dialing back some of the commitments to growth that they were initially contemplating, right, or looking at. The original version of the plan was looking at, you know, more of these nodes of sort of higher concentrations of density, and they dialed that back significantly. Like, that seems like the substantive shift here to me. The rhetoric, you know, okay, I happen to be,
yeah, and I wouldn't characterize it as mere rhetoric.
I'm even sympathetic to the argument, right, that you're saying is getting excised, but nonetheless, I'm not going to lose any sleep over the fact that, you know, it's not in this document. I'm much more interested in the substantive implications. So,
yeah, and I think it's all substantive because the document contains, as I said, different layers. And one layer is, you know, what are our goals as a city? And I don't know about blowing up single family zoning. I mean, I wouldn't characterize it that way. The August version of the plan, I mean, it is more ambitious. It is not super ambitious. I mean, these 48 or 49 neighborhood nodes that were, you know, that got whittled down to 24, they're small. And they would have been bigger in the original version of the plan. They called for 1,000-foot radius instead of the 800-foot radius that the mayor's office whittled it down to. But, you know, I mean, we're not talking about apartments throughout single family neighborhoods, you know, which is what, you know, as Sandeep, that is what I'd like to see. Yeah. But I'm a pro density person. I don't think we're even within like a million miles of that with any version of this plan. And so we're talking about like changes at the margins. And I do think on the political point, I mean, it is interesting. Murray did get in a lot of trouble for the housing affordability and livability agenda because he talked about, you know, allowing more slightly, very, very slightly more density in single family areas. And now I think the pushback is coming from those 2/3 of people that want more density. And, you know, I think it may be more than 2/3, but that were reflected in the chamber poll. I think the pushback is coming from those people telling Harrell, you're not going far enough. So I think we actually really have shifted from the time of Murray to now. And I think Harrell is out of touch with that.
So, yeah, see, you agree with me.
The language you're using, like original draft plan. I mean, what's the status of an original draft plan? This is something that staffers come up with, right? I mean, it has no real status at all. Get watered down, but it's almost like you're talking about the Constitution or something. You're an originalist. We should move back to let's go back to the original plan.
I'm actually not arguing that this should. I'm saying there are two drafts.
Yeah.
There was one that was submitted to the mayor's office. So
by
it's
whom?
Not like there's
Who
a
made
million
it?
Different
who's,
drafts.
Who's
the Office of Planning and Community Development?
Yeah. Got it. OPCD, right?
Got it. Bureaucrats created the original plan.
Yeah, staff
that
at
we
OPCD.
Like better because
I'm
it's
like
because it's got
about
more
your
density.
Objection. Did you want the mayor himself to write it or
no? I mean, no, always, I'm just saying. I'm just
guess,
saying the
unquote,
language. It's like it's a
draft.
It's a draft plan that, like, whatever. Like, what status does it really have?
Well,
as
then
a draft
you're sort
plan?
Of shitting on my story.
No, not at all. I think it's super. Like, I think it's super like interesting. It's a, but my job is to shit on the arguments here. That's part of what I do, like devil's advocate. So yeah, I am kind of going.
What, you're saying my story is not newsworthy. That's
no,
cool.
No. I'm trying to let's just in the interest of clarity. Like, what are we really talking about here? Like, there was a staff-created plan that the mayor didn't like.
We're talking about this consensus of, you know, of people who are experts on this stuff, you know, to whatever extent you agree with their expertise or not, who were asked to come up with a plan according to, you know, specifications set by the mayor. They did it, and the mayor's office, you know, said hell no, and they changed it. And I think that is super newsworthy. Yep. I mean,
no, that's
not
helpful. That's
originalist.
Helpful. That's all I wanted you to do was clarify. Right. That's what I was going for.
This was the planners and the way the relationships work in the city is that the mayor is the executive, right? Has executive authority over all of the departments, but the mayor's office is small, right? It's not like all the work happens inside the mayor. So the mayor has a couple of people in his policy shop, right? So the actual work of government, the kind of planning and stuff happens at the, you know, departmental level. So what we're seeing here and what Erica has unearthed is that the planners at OPCD had made basically a recommendation, written a draft plan, you know, that recommended this level, you know, here's the approach we would take and this, you know, 48 of these nodes or whatever, right? And to Erica's point, like the mayor's office came in and said, that's too much. We want to dial it back some and did. Right. And they do have the ultimate authority. And what they transmit over to council is, you know, is the official document. But it's interesting to get insight into what the bureaucratic or none of these people are partisan. So calling them nonpartisan staff is kind of the wrong term. But you know what I mean here. The
back
less
and
political,
forth is interesting.
Yeah. 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 The less political staff. So Erica's earlier point, though, I think Erica's right. I do think the politics around this stuff has changed. And I think the push here compared to what happened during the HALA process in 2016 or whenever it was. But 8 years later, the push is all coming from the other direction. And I, for one, am super curious about what this council is going to do. With the official version of the plan that got pushed forward, are we going to see, you know, they're not, I doubt they're going to make radical changes, but are we going to see them move back at least to some extent towards the OPCD draft or not? I don't know.
Yeah, the council has, I mean, a lot of the council members have indicated that they are hearing from constituents that they want more density and that they want to take that into account when they, you know, work on this plan and get it. Now, to what extent that's actually going to happen, I mean, really remains to be seen. But I think there may be some pushback. And I think, too, you know, if you look at, I spent some time after the story came out, looking at constituent responses, just basically the surveys that they did. And the surveys were overwhelmingly, people said, we want more housing in our neighborhoods. We want more housing. We need housing for affordability. That is not what's reflected in this plan. So it kind of, there's also a situation where you have this huge public process and the public said one thing and the mayor's office did the opposite. I mean, arguably, you know, and so I think that that's also an issue when when you have the public saying on this specific plan, here's what we want, and that's not what they get. That's a problem. And, you know, I went to an open house recently for the comprehensive plan. And when I was sort of eavesdropping on conversations, that's what people were saying was, I want more density.
Which among the council members would you say is the most open to more density, Erica, or can you name them?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, I don't know about most, but I think Rob Saka might be. I think Tanya Wu might be. I think Kathy Moore might be. You know, maybe even Sarah Nelson. I don't know about her position on this specific thing, though, because she's been a little inconsistent. You know, Dan Strauss, Tammy Morales, you know, across the board, there's an openness, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that you read it that way. I mean, I think coming out of the campaigns, right, there was a sense that, like, some of the challengers that lost were the quote unquote urbanist candidates and were the pro density candidates. So I actually think some of that was sort of misguided. We talked a little bit about this, you know. I mean, you had sort of Ron Davis running against Mirza Rivera, anointed as the urbanist candidate, and then he's signing pledges about how he'll never upzone the U district, right? And not suffering any political consequences for it from his sort of, you know, tribal support in sort of movement urbanism or whatever.
Most of the candidates said they supported an alternative in the comprehensive plan that was significantly more dense than this proposal and much more similar to the August proposal than what the mayor proposed. So they all said I think Maritza Rivera did not, but a number of the candidates said they supported alternative 5. And this is sort of alternative 4.5.
Is it 6 or 5?
Alternative 6 was not an official alternative.
Oh, I heard them saying Plan 6 sometimes in some of the. So
that
I,
was
I
what the that. Activists. The activists had their own version of an even bigger plan that they called
that Alex Hudson, your candidate, supported.
I get it. Yeah,
I thought it was funny in debates where they would just talk about their support for Plan 6 when nobody in the audience had any idea what the fuck they were talking about, or Plan 5, or Plan 1.
That was very funny. I mean, that was the problem. You know, that was the questioners. On the questioners a little bit, I think.
Yeah,
for going
Plan 6 from
TV.
Outer space. I'm for Plan 6 from outer space. So,
Sandy, if you were for Plan, you were for alternative.
He was for Plan 7. He was for alternative 7.
Yeah, I'm for Plan 9, man.
Oh, my God. Okay, Boomer.
God, I actually want to ask now, you've inspired me, Erica, to ask like a lesser Seattle question. All of this density, obviously, it's in some ways better for the environment. It's better than sprawl. But it's not necessarily, as John Fox would tell you back in the day, or Knute Berger, going to lead to more affordability. I mean, it could, but, you know, like, look at all the super dense cities around the globe. Paris, London, New York, Tokyo, not very affordable, super dense, much denser than Seattle. So you can say that you're going to point to this rosy future of more greater affordability, but it's no panacea, is it? Let's be honest.
Well, I mean, Seattle is at a massive housing deficit right now. And one of the reasons that housing is so unaffordable in Seattle is that there are more people than there is housing to fit everybody. So people get shoved out to the suburbs. You know, the price of mid-range housing is now what you would expect for very high-end housing. We have a housing deficit. And one of the things that sort of got cut out, some of the rhetoric that got cut out of this comp plan is, you know, just a lot of talk about the fact that we need housing abundance. And the idea is, you know, if you have enough housing or more than enough housing, I mean, yes, the new housing is never going to be the affordable housing unless it's, you know, explicitly affordable housing, you know, built by nonprofits and stuff. But we're at a housing deficit. This comp plan proposes to maintain that deficit and actually make it a little bit worse by building 100,000 units for 200,000 or more people over the next 20 years. And so we're not fixing the housing deficit that we have now, and we're building less housing than we need for the people who are going to be coming here. So of course, housing's not going to get more affordable. Now, Is it a panacea to add 24 new neighborhood centers or allow housing on arterial streets? No, that's not going to be enough either. But it's definitely better than saying we're going to continue to provide less housing than we need for the people that are already here and the people that are coming.
Right. Well, I think the argument that we can build enough that we're going to significantly lower the cost of housing in Seattle is not very convincing, I don't think. Not to me. And the Seattle Times has released some polling, I think, last week, right? I think it was Heidi Gruber wrote a story about how there's polling that shows that most people, I think it was a statewide poll in the state, don't, you know, are suspicious of the idea that housing prices are going to be more affordable because we build more. But
that wasn't the question. I mean, who cares about polling? Is it true that if we keep constraining, you know, and not building housing, that, you know, that will be the same as, you know, the effect if we build a lot of housing?
If you'd let me finish my point, I was going to say,
I've devised this new tactic. It's called interrupting.
Yeah, yeah. But the reality. The reality in Seattle has been over the last decade plus that we have had a massive run up in housing costs, right? And so I think that's likely to continue, if anything. If we continue to have growth rates like we did over the last decade, and there's a mismatch between demand and supply, we're going to continue to see more and more expensive housing. We're still not to San Francisco yet in terms of how expensive our housing is, though it's become enormously more expensive than it used to be here. And so I do think building more housing is important. Even if it doesn't lower costs, at least we will bend the curve on the rise in housing costs in a significant way. And I do think that's important. I don't know that we'll ever achieve a nirvana where suddenly it's like, you know, you can be a dishwasher and earn minimum wage and find housing affordable in Seattle. That seems like a pipe dream at this point. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be doing everything we can to bend the curve.
Well, let's make the transition here just by saying that if Shama Sawant were still in the council, she would be shaking her head in disgust at the fact that the progressive left has now embraced some of the underlying principles of free market capitalism and the laws of supply and demand. It's disgusting, you know, to hear that kind of rhetoric coming out of both of your mouths.
Yeah, is
I think what she would say if she were here.
Yeah, on that point, David, I think that is because you're putting your finger on a point that's worth unearthing a little bit, which is that even 10 years ago, there was a significant contingent on the left, Shama being one of them, that really did come out of this sort of anti-displacement place that looked at growth and development with suspicion as a tool to make Seattle more expensive and to drive out lower income and minority communities, right?
Yeah, that when you tear down crappy old housing that's cheap, like housing, and build new housing, that housing is potentially more expensive. I mean, of course we have a housing deficit, but that is what happens.
Interestingly, that was one thing that was cut out of the anti-displacement plan. I would say the comp plan still reflects some of that, Sandeep. There's still, you know, a concept of high displacement neighborhoods, which is why, you know, there are some areas that are just totally exempt from House Bill 1110.
Right.
It's because of that principle. And I agree. I mean, it's not wrong. You know, you have to figure out ways to, you know, prevent displacement or you know, address it. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely changed a lot in the time, you know, since the sort of time when John Fox was a very vocal presence arguing that tearing down any kind of existing housing is bad.
Yeah. Nick Licata, who was, you know, by far the left populist on the council for years, right? Nick was a socket to developers sort of anti-growth kind of guy, right? He was an old school Seattle lefty. He wasn't an urbanist by any stretch. Nikita Oliver in their first race for mayor was coming from this sort of anti-development, socket to developers kind of take. And it was interesting. They evolved 4 years later when Nikita was running was much more sounding, a much more urbanist tune. And I do think that's also emblematic or indicative of the shift that we've been talking about for the last couple of episodes.
We've gone over that territory before. For close listeners to this podcast, it's like hearing Uncle so and so at the Thanksgiving dinner retelling the same stories. So
when I was working for Carta
back in the old days, John Fox Place just opened up on Aurora Ave.
Margaret Pagler once told me that.
All right.
And I should say, I'm a fan of John Fox. I think he has done a lot of good in the city. I just don't agree with him on this particular issue.
Right.
But we are both, in favor of helping poor people and affordable housing. We just come at it a different way, I think.
All right, we'll leave it there. That's it for another edition of Seattle Nice. She's Erica C. Barnett. He's Sandeep Kaushik. I'm David Hyde. Our editor is Quinn Waller. And you, the listeners, are also our supporters when you go to patreon.com/Seattle Nice, as more than 100 folks have decided to do. So please chip in on that and help keep this podcast coming your way. And to everybody, thank you so much for listening.